This podcast contains explicit language.
Hello there, and welcome to the latest episode of Drinking and Talking. On this episode, we dive deep into what's going on with the Republican primary. I actually don't know what's going on with the Republican primary. That's why we have these guests on to help explain. With us today, Katie Packard, Mitt Romney's former deputy campaign manager. We have Reed Epstein, a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. We have Mary Bono, a former member of Congress. And we have Mark Hemingway, a senior writer with the Wall Street Journal. So sit back, grab your cocktail, and enjoy the show.
So where do we begin when we want to talk about the state of the Republican Party? I think maybe the end of the 2012 election and the autopsy report. When you look back at that and you look at now, what do you think, as the elected, as the one person who's been elected to office?
I think you wouldn't have predicted that we would be where we are. as we were saying moments ago, the Romneys were such great, decent, thoughtful people. I think everybody who worked on the campaign or was ran that campaign appreciated that they were thinkers and lovers and kind people. And we've come so far from that. And I don't think anybody would have predicted we would be where we are today. But
I don't know about that. I mean, this is not a slam on Republicans necessarily, but if you look at who the Republicans have nominated post-Reagan, I mean, George H.W. Bush, you know, one term, Dole flamed out spectacularly. George W. Bush, who did, you know, survive two terms, but, you know, ran as a conservative, added new cabinet agencies, vastly expanded the federal budget and other things like that. And then John McCain, and then Mitt, you know, Romney. At some point, voters really wanted something that was more definitively conservative, you know, and that's not a dig on the individual candidates necessarily. I mean, I agree Romney would have been certainly a better president than Obama by, you know, light years. But at some point, the establishment was much less conservative than the base, and it just caught up with
them. Was there like a specific point where you think that became abundant clear, or you went across the proverbial Rubicon here?
I don't know. I mean, Trump is obviously a pretty good demarcator in that respect. But having said that, you know, what's weird is Trump has just thrown a complete monkey wrench into this entire thing, because you take Trump out of the equation, I look at the candidates and what we've seen this year, I think the Republican Party is in great shape ideologically and otherwise in terms of candidates. But Trump has thrown so many crazy things into the electoral calculus and what it's causing other candidates to do and say. It's just, you know, complete and total goat rodeo, and I don't know where we go from here.
Hence my point.
Yeah. I don't know that I would necessarily cede the point that the base, you know, that the base is so much more conservative and it's caught up and, you know, the party's doomed. If you look at 2012, for a pretty good chunk of the primary, Mitt was sitting, you know, somewhere in the, you know, late teens, mid-20s, which means that about 75% of the party was saying they wanted Bachman, Teepaw, Perry, Kane, Gingrich. And so there was a sense back then that the primary electorate was much more conservative than where Mitt was. Ultimately, they came together when it came down to a couple of candidates. The decision was made that they wanted somebody that was conservative enough, they thought could be competitive, they thought could raise money, they thought wouldn't embarrass the party. That's where they fell down. I don't know that we know yet whether or not the party's going to end up there. Right now, we know this for sure, that about 78% of the party really likes Donald Trump. Probably about 70% of the party really doesn't like Donald Trump. So there's no reason to think that Donald Trump is ultimately going to prevail, other than right now he sort of leads. He does seem to have incredibly high negatives, much higher than Mitt ever had, for the front runner. And, you know, the rest of the candidates sort of look and feel a lot more like what we've seen in previous years. So I think the jury's sort of still out on where the base is going
to
fall.
By the way, we have a rule. If you mention Teepaw, you have to drink. So here we
go. I'll do that.
To Teepaw. May you be watching this show.
I mean, I think that there are lines to be drawn from 2012 to 2016.
Draw them for us, Reed.
Romney. Trump in 2011, we remember the whole.
It's easy to mix those two up.
Yeah. They're very similar. Yeah. But both have amazing hair.
Amazing hair.
One has amazing hair.
And much richer than all of us.
Yes. But
Trump captivated a segment of the Republican populace in 2011 with the whole birther saga.
Sure.
And was powerful, was important enough that Mitt Romney took a high-profile endorsement from him shortly before the Nevada caucuses at a Trump hotel in Las Vegas.
Yeah, he showed up at his hotel.
He showed up. They stood together. That might have been the most awkward and nervous I remember Romney looking through the whole campaign. More nervous than when he had to stand up and explain the 47% video was when he was standing arm in arm with Donald Trump at his casino.
Well, it might have been a tie with when Meatloaf came out.
Wait, paint the scene for us about Meatloaf. I remember the Meatloaf thing, but what was happening?
Well, he played at an event. It actually wasn't a particularly awkward thing, but you know, nothing says Mitt Romney like Meatloaf.
There was another moment though, because I was on the trail with Mitt when we had this great idea that he would go out and sing God Bless America because it was happening everywhere.
Oh, at the Villages.
At the Villages. And we thought that he would have a whole bunch of, you know, people behind him singing with him.
Whose idea was that for him to sing that?
No.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I know. Look at him. Oh, she did. Okay. Yeah.
I remember I was
The Villages loved it.
The Villages. No, but it was funny. So
YouTube
he gets up on stage. None of us thought that, I mean, all day there were people behind
you
him.
You asked him to sing that?
We said, and who is his campaign man? You know, who's his best friend? Bob.
Bob,
right? So we go, this is a great thing because it's been happening all day spontaneously. These people behind you are bursting out in song. Next time, why don't you lead it? But we didn't realize there was nobody on stage behind him. And he'd be singing a cappella into a microphone. And we were just, oh, no, we didn't think this thing through. So I'm glad that your two moments might have been worse than
Well, just think, Mitt Romney's most embarrassing moment was singing God Bless America. That's that pales in comparison to the 2016.
That's some excellent spin.
Yeah,
but I will say...
We need to talk about this moment a little bit more because I remember being there at the Village and been like a long day, like running all across Florida.
Sure.
Yeah.
And he starts singing, and I remember my editor for some reason was at this event, and he turned to me and he's like, "Oh, this guy's not going to be president."
That's such a lame way to
just took the blame.
I think the Trump story though is actually kind of interesting, more so than the Village story.
The Trump endorsement.
Great. Yeah, because it did seem like in 2011. I don't know. It seemed like a lot of them wanted to have whatever it was he was bringing to the table, but clearly were recognized that this guy was a little bit off and maybe dangerous. But they didn't know how to do it. I mean, they were actively seeking his approval while simultaneously trying to not get too close.
To be clear, Mitt Romney was never seeking his approval.
Okay.
What Mitt Romney was seeking was to have Donald Trump not crap all over our campaign for the entire year. And those were the options. He was either on your team and, you know, to some degree would be supportive. You couldn't manage him or control him in any way. But at least, you know, in his own way and with his people, he would be supportive and would maybe go after your opponents.
So he screwed you
the other
way.
Option is that he would be at your throat all the time. And so the calculation was made that it's better to have him on the team and whatever baggage that brings with us.
Or at least muzzled,
To some degree, muzzle him. Yeah. It was a very awkward moment, for sure, for those of us that were there observing it. It was awkward for Mitt. And, you know, even then, I used to tell people before all of this started how hilarious it was backstage because we had just won the Florida primary and had this massive primary night with more press than we had ever encountered on the campaign at that point in time. Yeah. I mean, hundreds of cameras in the back of that ballroom. And we show up at this hotel in Las Vegas, and we're backstage, and all Donald Trump can talk about is how this is the biggest event that we've had so far. Isn't it the biggest? Isn't it the biggest?
And he was
on and on.
And you guys were all like, "Yes, Mr. Trump."
And finally I said, "Yes, Mr. Trump, yours is the biggest." And I don't think he got exactly what I was getting at. That's just what he wanted to hear. But it was like, this guy is so obsessed with size that it's like a comic book.
I was just going to say that makes perfect sense about, you know, Trump saying embrace me or else. And if you look at what's happened the past year, somehow he's gotten everyone in or much of the political and media establishment to make the same decision.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really kind of amazing how much power he has in that regard. I mean, what he spent $217,000 in ads, and here he is.
Which for the viewers is nothing.
It's Donata, and it's just incredible.
It's a half a day. In New Hampshire,
obviously the cat's out of the bag, and you know, present company excluded or whatever. But I mean, I just don't know how we don't all look at ourselves, you know, in the media and elsewhere, and say, oh my God, what have we done?
Well, it does seem like...
That is a really good question, and I think every reporter should evaluate that along with their editors.
Let me stand up for the media just a little bit.
Oh, good.
Okay, because I'm not going to stand. Please, I actually am not going to stand up for
But I mean, this is somebody who has support of between a quarter and a third of the Republican electorate, depending on what polls you
Now
get.
He does.
Now he does.
But did he always?
Well, make your point.
From almost... And he's launched his campaign in late June, and he took over the polling lead in a couple weeks into July. And so it's not like there was some...
To push back on that, so did Mitt. And I don't remember at what point our events started being broadcast live as breaking news.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure it wasn't until he was the nominee.
Right, but I mean,
Romney
wasn't saying, like, newsy and, like, wildly interesting things.
No, but the notion that when he lands to do an event in Alabama... That CNN goes to the plane landing because this is somehow breaking news that Wolf Blitzer has to cover a plane landing. It's absurd. You have to acknowledge that that's absurd.
It is absurd, but CNN wouldn't do it if it didn't draw in.
Is that what the news business is about? Really, is it just totally become an entertainment industry that it's about viewers, or is it actually about communicating what's news?
I mean, even though Sam bought a strings, this isn't a charity for anybody.
Oh,
right.
Oh, I thought it was.
But I mean, it's supposed to. I mean, if you're going to call yourself a news organization, shouldn't you really be devoted to what's news?
Before we get into an ethics and journalism debate, I will say there is
an
analogy.
Too like oxymoron.
Yeah, I know.
Ethics and door.
I do think there's something to it, though. We all sort of invited him in because he gave us benefits in some way, ratings or money or attention or the lack of vitriol.
Look, Bush is boring. I mean,
we're going to get to Bush.
Jeb is the most capable, probably, person we have.
But to your point, I think it's almost like, I mean, this is a bad analogy, but it's like how the Joker survived in Batman, which is they needed him, they wanted him, they invited him, and then shit really fucking hit the fan.
Right.
And now you're sitting there and you're wondering, wait a second, do we create this?
Look, I get the embracing the Trump phenomenon, at least initially. Like, I mean, you know, Reed's absolutely right. You know, they need ratings, you know, they need to pay the bills, keep the lights on, whatever. And if Trump does that, you know, great, more power to them. But at some point, you do cross a threshold, and we're way past that point. You know, you have to stand back and say, like, okay, what are we doing? Because Trump's entire campaign, it's been substance free. It's a tautological car crash of I'm leading in the polls because the polls show I'm leading. I mean, that's literally been his entire campaign. And at some point, you just need to step back and say,
Well, let's get to that point about how the part of the problem is basically the alternative hasn't really emerged. And why not?
Okay, in my view, first of all, look, he says the most ludicrous, outlandish, offensive things in the world, but he ties them up with this little tiny bow that still speaks to people. No Muslims should be allowed into America, right? Offensive. Nobody likes that statement, but he ties it up with, you know, war is tough, winning is tough. And the American people, some people go again, oh, great, winning, we want to win again. I forgot that he just said something so offensive and horrible, but we want to win.
Sure.
But the person I think has got to be kicking himself is Chris Christie, because Trump is... He's more Chris Christie than Chris Christie. You know, Chris was that guy
what do you
who
mean
was
by that? Yeah.
Governor Christie was. He was never afraid to be tough, to take on the audience, to offend somebody. And then Bridgegate happened, and it sucked all the air out of his own campaign. But he was the guy who was never politically correct. He was never afraid to take somebody on, but he took it too far. And now Trump is out Chris Christieing Chris Christie, in my view. So I think Governor Christie's got to be just wondering, where do I go, or do I pick up these pieces when Trump falls?
That's a very good observation.
Well, what's the deal with the... I mean, the question I had asked was, what's the deal with the Republican governor class? Because that was supposed to be the bread and butter of the GOP field.
I don't think anybody in the GOP is excited about, you know, nominating and electing a junior senator after the last, you know, several years.
Fine.
Having said that, I don't think that that's a comment necessarily on the fact that there's a problem with governors in the abstract. And the problem is more about the specific candidates. I mean, Scott Walker ran just a terribly managed campaign. You know, whatever you want to say about him personally, whatever about his skills as a governor, it was a incredibly poorly run campaign, and in retrospect, it's not surprising it fell apart. You know, Jindal, for whatever reason, you know, he was embattled at home, was too young, didn't have enough money. And the big loss for me, though, is Rick Perry. I mean, there's a case to be made he's the most successful governor in modern history, strictly on, you know, policy, you know, successes and things that he's done.
You're leaving out the people in the race who are struggling, like Jeb.
Right.
I mean, Jeb is just treading water.
If you could just magically install him in the White House, I'm sure he would be a fine president. But he's been an absolutely terrible candidate. To say that he has misread the electorate and everything at every opportunity. I remember a month ago when they rolled out that slogan or whatever, Jeb can fix it. I'm like, how out of touch is this guy? Yeah. Republican voters want to burn it to the ground and salt the earth. And you're saying, oh, we can fix this. No, yeah. Nobody wants it fixed.
Yeah. Well, there's some evidence to be...
Is that what they
to
want?
Be considered, that Jeb was never particularly good at being a candidate. You know, if you look at the races that he ran, in 1994, it was tough to lose as a Republican.
Yeah, and he did it.
And he lost. And, you know, I wasn't close to that race, but, it is interesting that in a year when almost every Republican in the country won, that he didn't win, the son of a president. In 1998, he won, but again, a year...
He might have been president now if he'd won in 94.
Well, I don't know about that. Here's what I have heard president. As sort of conventional wisdom, that, you know, if they had both won, that he would have been president instead of W. I would argue that George W. Bush has certain skills that are called for when running for president of the United States that are different from running for governor or running for Congress or something statewide. He's very good at that. He's a flirt. He flirts with men and women alike. Oh. He charms people.
Huh. He flirts with men.
He's very engaging. I mean that in a way he sort of pulls people in and people want to be liked by him. And they want to like him. And he had that sort of it factor.
It's charisma.
That Jeb never has really had. And without a doubt, he was a very successful governor and a good governor. But I'm not sure he ever actually had the skills it takes to run.
What was like the quintessential Jeb moment from this campaign so far? For me, it was his like complete inability to answer the most obvious Iraq question that was going to come his way. And like when he took four times to figure out an answer.
I thought when he was on Colbert and he said that the exclamation point in his logo connotes excitement.
That's pretty good.
Because if there's one thing that is completely missing from the Jeb campaign, it's excitement.
And it connotes it.
So if you're one like, using the word connote to reach
such
Republican
a weird
voters.
Well, look, I thought he's running for chief of staff. Yeah. He would make, he look. It's like you could make a great chief of staff at the White House, but he's not.
Right.
But the sad thing is, and I don't know if you've all, and you've debated, I mean, but debating as a candidate, it is a hard, hard thing.
Yeah.
It's hard to say, how will you save the free world? You have 30 seconds to tell us.
Right.
And it's a special gift, and it's a gift of gab and excuse the French, but bullshit, right? You have to excel at bullshit. Jeb does not excel at bullshit.
Yeah, the
but
debate
he can
with
excel
Rubio was
at
rough.
Running.
Well, is it fair to sort of draw analogies to Jeb's awkwardness and some of the Romney stumbles or the awkward moments that he had?
I think that,
not to keep crapping on Romney.
Look, I think that every candidate has difficult moments and awkward moments. But I think that Mitt was a much better candidate than he is given credit for.
Mitt's awkward moments were more endearing, I feel like. You're like,
well,
there goes Mitt again.
But Mitt got us, and Mitt could stir up a crowd. Mitt could get a crowd up on their feet. He could get people excited. I remember going to CPAC after the 2012 election and listening to a lot of these presidential wannabes talk, and it was just flat all morning. And then Mitt got in there, and I mean, and this was not really his audience.
Yeah.
But I mean, the crowd lit up because he's good at it. And he wasn't really given enough credit for being just a really good candidate. And I don't want to crap all over Jeb. I mean,
he's,
you know, his challenges are very obvious. But, you know, part of the challenge that he has is if you talk to Republican primary voters out there, they say, look, I love the Bushes. I loved the first President Bush. I love George W. Bush. I think Jeb's a great guy, a really nice guy. I just don't think we should have another Bush.
Right.
My mom is somebody that is, you know, like she almost feels guilty for not being for Jeb because she just feels like it should be somebody else's turn.
Jeb's mom felt the same way for a little while.
For all the woes that we're listing of our candidates, it's surprising that the Democrats can't take advantage. They're really not. Mm-hmm. They're muddling along, treading water.
In fact, a Suffolk poll just came out showing that, you know, Trump was within 3 or 4 points of Hillary in a head-to-head matchup. Trump!
We'll get to the Democrats by the end of this. But what's your...
Oh, good.
Well,
what's
I was
going to
say...
I need to drink a little bit more for that. Can you pass the gin over
in,
here?
In addition to...
Sam drinking more.
In addition to what Katie just said about Jeb, which I think is a really good point, I would just also add that what Jeb is doing in this race is also significant in the sense that Jeb has enabled Trump. And that's been a problem. Like, he's been a bad candidate from the get-go. He raised a ton of money and just stood out there as the epitome of this Republican establishment death star that a lot of these more conservative voters were sick of. And he was sort of the yin to Trump's yang, you know, that it was literally like this situation where, oh no, we're going to get another rhino establishment like Jeb unless we go, you know, full banana pants crazy on the other side with Trump. And I think that if Jeb could do one good thing for the party, it would be to somehow take the $75 million left he's got in the bank or whatever and just, you know, detonate, you know, Trump on his way out of the race.
The Jeb Super PAC released an ad on this morning. We're doing this on Tuesday.
Yeah,
Tuesday morning.
The date is Tuesday. We're December 8th.
Is this the Oval Office desk ad?
The Oval Office desk ad where they said that Trump is...
They went after Trump and they went after Rubio and Cruz.
So which goes to your point earlier that we want this arch-conservative, until we don't, because he's against protecting Americans.
Exactly.
So I'm still on the topic of governors, putting Jeb aside, because let's be a little bit, you know, sympathetic to the guy. Let's not pile on completely. As a Scott Walker reporter, and he talked about it, but what happened?
They spent... similar problems as what we saw with Ben Carson, where Walker, he did really well in some early spring polling. His campaign guys saw their polling numbers and said, "We're doing great. We can, they build up a big campaign. We don't have to change anything with the polls."
Sure.
And they used the polling numbers to justify decisions as opposed to any sort of larger comprehensive strategy.
You don't have to be that quiet with me.
We're
really, really quiet with this.
Sorry, Reid, you're making a quick point.
And so they had, you know, 80, 90 some people on staff for a campaign that once Trump got in the race, sort of disappeared in the polls. He had a couple of really bad debates.
Yeah.
And the money dried up, and all of a sudden they couldn't support staff they had.
So why not go bare bones? That's been my question the entire time.
But there's a bigger thing.
Well, the other
issue. I love telling reporters the truth.
Yeah, what's the bigger thing?
No, Scott, look, this is the age of authenticity. We like Trump because he says it as he sees it.
Sure.
We want to see an authentic candidate. Scott Walker is the epitome of a glib candidate. It's like he's rehearsed. He was scripted, he was measured, he was stiff. He didn't have the authenticity I think people were like searching for and seeking, that they want somebody just say how you feel. I think Scott was so careful and so safe that...
I felt like that was Jindal, too, in some respects.
Yep.
He seemed like he knew what he wanted to say, but that was it.
Jindal struck me as a candidate who was just running as... was a really strong... yeah. candidate and had a great story, but he was sort of running as somebody else. He was this very smart, accomplished guy.
Did he run? Oh, yeah.
And he was like all of a sudden running as the pastor of Iowa.
Mm.
And it didn't really make sense to me. It struck me as a campaign where people were sitting there, you know, with this kind of 1980s model of the only place that matters is Iowa, so let's do and say whatever we have to do to win the pastors in Iowa and the conservatives in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And they just ran this campaign totally focused on social issues and, you know, evangelical conservatism. And it wasn't a suit that he wore particularly comfortably.
Yeah, I agree with that. And down to the announcement video, which was completely... and utterly awkward. I don't know if anyone remembers the Jindal announcement video.
That's the one with the kids sitting
around
the table under the tree.
He rigged a camera in a tree, and he's like telling his kids, and it was like a secret camera thing. It just seemed really weird.
Yeah, it almost felt like a too personal family moment
be
shared with the whole
world. I don't want to see this. Like, just tell your kids and then do it.
It's kind of like, have you seen the Ted Cruz outtakes?
Yes,
those are so good.
No.
Oh, they're so good.
Where he makes his kids pray 6 times in a row over the dinner table.
Well, funnily enough, that you bring that up is because I think one of the problems, of course, is that Walker had was the structure of his campaign. I mean, he'd set this up where, you know, all this heavy emphasis on the super PAC directing things, and then with all of the laws and strictures about, you know, not coordinating things, like, there was nobody, like, you know, commanding the ship. And that really hurt him. I'm, you know, somewhere down the line, somebody may figure out how to do that super PAC coordination thing, and it might work out. And,
you're
you know,
right.
they'll look at
too
Walker.
Too clever by half.
Right. They'll look at Walker as some, you know, brave, you know, trailblazer, but until then,
and Carly and Jindal have been doing the same thing, and I think it's difficult.
I thought, which is her campaign, her super PAC is in charge of all the, you know, staffing and GOTV stuff, and
I wouldn't say that somebody down at two has quite mastered it.
But she doesn't have to do anything. Yeah. I mean, she doesn't have to pay for anything. It's insane.
And she's also, as far as, I mean, she's at 2%, so it's not too carried away. But like, as far as the balance, as far as like who does what, and you know, she doesn't have to raise a ton of money because she has
two people,
minimal staffers, and so it takes a half dozen millionaire donors to fund the super PAC. And she is, as transparent as anybody about the schedule. Her public schedule is online a month out on a Google document that anybody can go look at.
Including
the super PAC so that they can plan and be at events and yada, yada, yada. But I think it's harder if you're scaled up to have, it's easier to do that if you're, raising a couple million dollars and you're at 4%. But we saw when Carly had her moment when, she and Trump had the whole face thing back and forth. She had
describe a little bit for people
where, Donald Trump had mocked her appearance a couple days before the September debate in California, and she responded during the debate that something to the effect of like
every woman in America has
seen this face, and I've earned all of these wrinkles. This is my face.
Well, actually, she said every woman in America knows what you meant.
Knows what you meant.
It was a very direct attack.
Kind of an F you.
It was really the only moment in the whole campaign that anyone has landed a punch on Trump.
Yeah.
Was that moment from Fiorina, and she got a couple of weeks of momentum out of it, and then sort of went back to where she was.
And maybe
but
that's
where
lesson.
A campaign team matters, because a campaign team would build on that. And that's one of the things, I've talked about with reporters that have asked, why hasn't Carly picked up steam? And I have felt that she had some really big moments, but they sort of failed to build upon them. That if you know your candidate does well in debates, then look for what you can do in the weeks following the debate to give those performances legs. And that's something that's very difficult if you have a very small operation and they haven't been able to capitalize on that.
My boss, Fred Barnes, has been saying that for months about both Carly and Ben Carson. I mean, they don't, for all of the excitement, they don't have the staffs and they don't seem to have the willingness to be looking for opportunities to ramp up and other things. And he's been saying forever that it was going to catch up with them, and sure enough, it has.
So are there any lessons then to be drawn about the role money now plays in this post-Citizens United world? Because on the one hand, you have these incredibly well-financed campaigns or these incredibly well-financed super PACs who don't do jack shit like Jeb's. On the other hand, you have sort of semi-innovative forms like Carly's. And then you have Donald Trump, who spends absolutely next to nothing and does well. So I don't feel like there's a coherent set of rules about how to utilize a post-Citizens United fundraising.
Well, I think this is great. I think this is how it's supposed to work. I think a lot of our campaign finance rules are silly, and I think that the notion that we need to have all these crazy campaign finance laws restricting what people can spend is just kind of crazy. I think that people don't realize that the internet and a lot of this information technology is still cycling through the culture. I mean, a lot of us in D.C. and other people are sort of been on the vanguard of this, so it all seems like old hat. But this is just catching up to like middle America in a lot of ways. So you're seeing a situation where information is being distributed a lot more freely from a lot more different outlets. And so it's much harder than it was in the 90s and 80s, where you could just go in and carpet bomb TV ads on the three local stations and get a real, dominant edge.
On the flip side, though, we have, not to like come off as too liberally, but we have like courtships of mega donors that we're seeing in real time.
Silly campaign finance rules that I'm not sure. That,
I know, you would like to see it all wiped out so that it would be an instant disclosure, but we are in a system now where, Marco Rubio's main objective at this point is to win the Adelson primary almost.
Well, I don't think it's fair to say that's his main objective.
The immediate objective.
But the reality that I think you can't consider Trump in terms of like lessons learned, because I do think that Trump is sort of a once in a lifetime kind of candidate, that he was sort of this public figure with a whole entertainment empire that decides to run for president. That's not going to happen every cycle. And the lessons learned of how he's, done with earned media aren't really going to apply to anybody else. That said, I do think that a lot of these candidates that got convinced by consultants that super PAC money is the same as regular money, and as long as you have two or three really big donors, you can go far, I think will not be so easily wooed.
Who do you think that applies to?
Well, I think pretty much every governor was under the impression that if they had a few deep pockets, you know, my home state governor of Michigan, you know, Governor Snyder considered, because, you know, he had some deep pocketed donors. You know, when I spoke to him, you know, I shared, I think, a different perspective, that there are some things that only a campaign can do, and you can't depend on super PACs to sort of fill this gap. And, you know, I think these candidates have figured that out, and I think that some of them may not have made the decision to run if they had known how difficult it was going to be. You know, maybe Scott Walker would have waited. You know, I don't know. Maybe Bobby Jindal would have waited.
That's a fun game to play. Who would not, knowing what they know now, who would not have run this cycle?
I think Jindal would have run because he was term limited and he was going to be out of
I don't think Walker would have run.
You think he would have waited?
If he had known that you were going to have to you know, actually raise money from across the board, you know, from small dollar donors. It, you know, it's a totally different kind of game.
Would Jeb have run?
I don't even think that Walker's problem was fundraising, at least not in the beginning. Yeah. Walker's problem was that he was dreadful in the debates, and that was when the donors disappeared. But up until that point, he was doing great until the August debate in Cleveland when he laid an egg. He was, and shortly after that was with the Iowa State Fair when he talked about, when he kind of sort of agreed with Trump on birthright citizenship.
I remember that.
And then spent a week sort of doing a jab, slowly.
I'm not saying that's why he got out, but if you you know, are sitting in these rooms as I have been, you know, doing the calculation of the money it takes to run and where is it going to come from, where you're putting it all up on a whiteboard, where, you know, how much can your contacts deliver? And for most of these candidates, they're looking at the National Republican Finance Network, and they were thinking Bush is going to own most of that. So what I can count on is what I have in my state. And the other thing people forget is that candidate ads are a lot cheaper than super PAC ads. If you're looking to buy a week of ad time in Iowa, you know, it might cost you $1 million. It probably costs $4 million for a super PAC to do the same thing. So there's the value isn't equal.
So I want to play this game. Who would not have run knowing what they know now? I think Jeb probably would have not run. I think he would have stayed on the sidelines, kept the options open, but not run. Scott Walker, I don't think, would have run. But I believe
this was Jeb's last time. I don't think he would have waited.
You think he would have still won?
I don't think Walker. I mean, Walker is a young guy. He still had time left in his term. I think he would have waited.
Who else would not have run? I feel like they all have a reason to be in it still. Like, even Huckabee.
I'm
like,
not sure. I'm not sure Christie would have won. I run. I think that Christie is somebody that probably would have made the calculation that he could have waited a little while, let Bridgegate get a little farther behind him. But he was very close to a lot of money, and I think he thought, if I can get to this, you know, if I can raise $15 million, whatever the number is, then I can be viable.
I don't know that I would count Christie out already.
Yeah, I know. So I think Christie still would have done it.
Oh, I'm not counting him out.
So I think he's still, at this point, knowing what he knows.
I'm just
now,
not sure he would have run because Bridgegate was so fresh when he made the decision to run.
In a campaign, your strategist will tell you, we can set everything up perfectly for you. Everything's going to be done right.
Yeah, but they want to make money.
Something's going to happen. It's going to be called what Arthur Finkelstein would call the hand of God. It's going to come in and wipe everything off the table, and everything is going to have to change. And that might have just happened. And, you know, with what's happened in Paris and San Bernardino, and I think that if that's the case, Chris Christie might be the one to break through with his strong messaging. And so I wouldn't count him out at all. If he's smart and he knows how to, you know, to turn this
Well, believe me, they're all looking for their moment in this next debate.
Yeah.
This debate in Las Vegas next week is going to be really critical, and all of them are going to look for how can I make a mark on Trump in the context of this statement that he just made yesterday.
But so to close this loop, though, I mean, to close this down, I don't think there's a single candidate other than Scott Walker who regrets having run at this point.
What about Lindsay?
He loves it.
He's having the best time
of his life. He's getting drunk with journalists.
And well, also, I can tell you that the other day I ran into Jim.
That's like his joy in life, is to get drunk with journalists.
Also, I mean, I think Lindsay genuinely ran to influence the foreign policy
debate. Maybe Rand Paul is like someone who wishes he had not done it.
Well, I mean, talk about, you know, how politics changes. I mean, you remember all the talk about libertarian moments or whatever? Like, you know, a couple of terror attacks later.
I can tell you that I ran into Jim Gilmore in the produce section of Harris Teeter.
He does not.
At 2 o'clock in the afternoon last Monday, and he did not seem, you know, overcome with regret.
Which Harris Teeter is Gilmore
Shop? And what was he?
The one in
getting?
Old Town.
I'm sorry. Who are they talking about? Yeah. I'm just kidding.
What was in his? What was he ordering?
I didn't look. I just said hello, Governor. I was a little surprised to see him.
He was picking
grocery.
His prescription. For
I mean,
Balfour.
Of course, I was also grocery shopping in the middle of the afternoon.
I would have thought he would have been an Instacart kind of guy.
Yeah, delivery probably. Yeah. Let's move a little bit to substance here.
Has this not been substantive?
This has been
sorry to disappoint
no,
you, Sam.
No. I facilitated this conversation. Oh, if you need to refresh your drink, feel free and go ahead.
We already did.
Yeah.
You're behind.
You're the one that's behind.
I bartended my whole way through college.
She poured me a gin and tonic. In terms of the Hispanic vote, which was like kind of the one of the main cruxes of the autopsy report, do you worry a lot about what's going on right now? What are they?
Don't you worry?
Yes, I guess. But what are they going to do when this is all said and done, and the primary that is, and have to pivot to the general election?
Well, I think it all depends on who the nominee ends up being. I do think that even. You know, with his flaws, if our nominee ends up being a Ted Cruz or a Marco Rubio,
because they're
of Hispanic origin, I think it would probably be more helpful if it's one that can speak Spanish, as Marco Rubio can.
Or Jeb Bush.
I mean, he's not Hispanic. I don't think it's the same.
But he speaks Spanish.
I'm talking about the historical nature of a first Hispanic candidate. I do think it's a game changer in terms of a general election. Obviously, if it's Jeb Bush and he can communicate in Spanish, that's also a game changer. I think there's an assumption right now that they're all going to be saddled with Trump's baggage. I don't know that that's true. I do think that the benefit to this is that Trump tends to be a brand in and of himself. He doesn't hug the Republicans very hard, and they don't hug him too hard.
Well, hold on a second. Before you go in, you want the first debate to be on Univision.
If not the first, I would call for that quickly. Okay. I speak Spanish somewhat okay, but... probably better than English at times, but
depending on how many
don't we all
exactly
or tequilas as it were.
But if you're Jeb or Marco, sure, you know, make your points. But when Hillary's doing it in English with an interpreter and they're rattling through in fluent Spanish, I think that's going to cut through.
That'd be a good contrast.
So. Yeah. The Hispanic issue is one that's really fraught for Republicans, which is to say that, like, all of the research and all the things showing this shows that the Republicans are becoming a very tribal party, in the sense that they're becoming a very white party. And for the longest time, you know, the only major swing vote that you couldn't reliably predict was going to vote on a partisan basis in this country were white people. And they're a majority of the country, so fortunately that kept things on sort of an even keel in terms of having Democratic elections where people could come out of nowhere and persuade people of their particular ideas. In the short term, Republican Party becoming much more heavily dependent on white people is great for the Republican Party. In the long term, this is horrible for the Republic.
But wait a minute.
Because now you're faced with a situation here where I think I crunched the numbers in a piece I wrote a couple months ago about this, but I mean the statistics were just astounding. Like Romney could have done like 40 points better with Hispanics and still lost. If he'd done 1 or 2 points better with white people, he would have won. And so now you're in a situation where I'm worried like all these Republican consultants who are getting paid big money to run these races are looking at the math and going, okay, what do I do to motivate white voters? Because that's the path of least resistance to winning. And that scenario that we're all staring
down.
That's
silly math because changing 1% to 2% of the white vote means persuading a huge swath of the public versus changing 10% of the Hispanic vote is in terms of actual numbers.
That's one way to look at it. But if you're looking at it in terms of campaign messaging, you know, it's a much more direct, blunt approach to just go after the margins
that's what's happened
of the white people.
Yeah.
And you're seeing that with Trumpism, frankly.
Yeah.
And what I'm worried is that this is going to be weaponized and tried, and people are going to try and repeat it because I just think ultimately that's just incredibly damaging. And the good news is we do have, you know, Rubios and Cruzes and people who are and Jebs who can actually
I mean, I talked to Lindsey Graham about this, about Rubio's movement away from that Gang of Eight bill. And he's obviously trying to win an election here, so take it for what it's worth. But he said that he thinks it's a debilitating move by Rubio in a general election that he abandoned the Gang of Eight bill. Because he thinks, regardless of all the personal biographical details, that he's going to get tarred with that in the Hispanic community.
Well, with all due respect to Lindsey Graham, I'm not sure that Marco Rubio is looking to take campaign advice from Lindsey Graham, who's sort of wallowing down there in the swamp and has very few Hispanic voters that he has to appeal to in South Carolina compared to Florida. To say it's debilitating, I think, is a huge stretch.
Sure.
But Lindsey, to Lindsey's credit, he has stood his ground a number of controversial issues.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, climate change, immigration, and he's the one saying to grow the party, we must. So, I mean, to his credit, he has not been shy, even though it's not South Carolina, but he has stood his guns on his record in the Senate, which has always been,
the other way to ask the question is, how problematic is abandoning the Gang of Eight bill?
You know, I just don't think it's, that's going to be the thing that's going to cause him problems. There might be other things that are going to cause him problems in a general election, but the reality is the Republican Party did this autopsy that determined what do we need to do to win a general election. And most of the base of the Republican Party basically snubbed their nose at it. Yeah. They don't really care what all these establishment Republicans in Washington determined was going to be necessary in order to win a general election. They want pure. They want angry. They want somebody that's going to stand up to, and be the opposite of Obama. So they don't really care what, all of these people, half of which are part of Team Jeb now, Henry Barber, Sally Bradshaw. I mean, these are folks that are, on the team. I think I should step back. I'm not sure that that's where Henry Barber is. Maybe he is.
I doubt it.
Austin Barber is.
I know Austin is. I just realized that as I was saying it.
But okay. Can't keep track of that.
But my point is that, they sort of reek of establishment Republicans. And the base, isn't really paying any attention to that. They want what they want. And they're not really looking very closely at, ideology that's going to win us, the election going up against Hillary. They want somebody that's pure on their issues.
The cleaving of the sort of Republican donor class and the grassroots, they are so far apart at this point that it's incredible. And like you were talking about, the establishment, the base has moved to the right, and the establishment hasn't. And that's the real sort of bifurcation at this point in the party, is that you have the people who are funding it have totally lost control of where the base is.
Yeah.
And they're totally alien to one another.
Right. Yeah.
They're speaking different languages.
And because Trump is sort of such a singular figure that the base can't control, but they can't outspend him. They can't, no one is at this point willing to dump in the $20 or $30 million that it would take to knock him on his heels, or force him to spend. I know that's what's remarkable, is that
force him to spend some cash.
No, Trump's in the third quarter spent $100,000.
Right.
He's out there saying he's self-financing his campaign, which is complete bullshit.
Yeah, I know.
And he has not had to spend any money.
Well, Katie made this point earlier, and then again, this speaks to where Jeb has almost screwed things up as badly as Trump, which is to say he locked up so much of that establishment money early on that it didn't leave enough on the table for the other candidates necessarily if they wanted to go after Trump.
They could never have envisioned this.
Well, it's true. But the point here is that they don't even have the option at this point in a lot of ways.
Sure.
But I thought it was really interesting a couple weeks ago when Marco Rubio was in Iowa, and he's having to talk to these pastors that, are sort of part of the game when you're looking to win Iowa. And they were actually sort of condemning him for taking money from Paul Singer, a guy that has spent more personal money to elect Republicans than anybody in the country,
Paul
has been an advocate of legalizing gay marriage.
He's launching a campaign to make that a platform in the Republican Party,
sure.
And you have to understand why that would make people...
I understand. I understand why, but the fact that they're so aware of that, I think, is really interesting. And the fact that they were sort of forcing Marco to answer for it, and I thought Marco's answer was really smart, and he said, when people sign up for my campaign, they buy into my agenda. I'm not buying into their agenda.
Marco Rubio does not believe in
absolutely not, according to what he has said.
Yeah.
But the fact that he was being challenged by a significant group within the grassroots of the Republican Party in Iowa for taking money from the biggest donor in the party. You'd think this guy might get some credit for having elected a lot of Republicans in this country, but there's no grace.
Let me close the question about the big tent of the Republican Party on this one. It's a very small voting block, so with that caveat, if you were a Muslim American Would there be any reason to vote for the Republican Party at this point?
Sure. Of course there would be.
What?
I mean, the notion, are you saying because of what Donald Trump has said?
Well, yeah, sure. Why not?
Well, because I don't think that most people think that Donald Trump speaks for the Republican Party. He has made some comments, and at every juncture, most of the leaders within our party have spoken out very aggressively against him. And there are a lot of issues on which Muslim Americans...
It's not just Trump, though, right? It's like Jeb saying we should let in Christian refugees, but not Muslims. Ted Cruz making...
Well, he's also not the leader of the Republican Party. And, you know, all of these candidates are making their case. But, you know, I come from Michigan, and I believe that Michigan has the largest concentration of Arab American and Muslim Americans in the country. And... there are a lot of folks that have been in Michigan for a long, long time that will tell you, one, we need to secure our borders. Mm-hmm. Two, we need to stop the threat of
the
radical Islam. All of our borders. Three, Republicans are job providers. I worked for years for the only Arab American member of the U.S. Senate, you know, and there was a lot of support for him from the Muslim American community. So there are plenty of reasons to support Republicans. And, you know, this story is far from being written in terms of the general election.
When Republican candidates for president, Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, Ryan's Priebus, are asked, would you support Trump if he's the nominee, knowing that he's saying all this, and they all say yes, what does that say? There?
I think none of them think he's going to be the nominee.
Of course none of them think he's going to be the nominee. Yeah,
I think they feel like it's a safe thing to but it's a safe comment to make.
I mean,
because
if they said that in the last 24 hours, for instance.
Paul Ryan said it this morning. And Mitch McConnell said it this afternoon.
And it's silly. He's not going to be the nominee.
Go ahead. Why? Well, it's a gotcha question, right?
No, well, it's a gotcha question, but you know what else is the fact that anybody's pigeonholed into this question, I think everybody ought to be able to look, the majority of Americans want to vote for somebody they believe in, somebody they like. They're not really beholden to the party. Believe it or not, all of the people we're talking about right now are the people who are paying attention, but the majority of people we care about on general election day are probably not paying attention right now.
And that's why Trump is competitive with Hillary, because he's the guy on the Republican side they've heard of.
He's slinging meat, and there's nothing easier for a politician than to sling meat to a crowd, and it's going to catch you in
the
end.
Well, I just think also it's worth pointing out here that if you're a Muslim sitting back here, I don't think the Republican Party is the only major party that's alarming you with their rhetoric and what they're doing. Don't get me wrong. Let's be clear here. I think what Trump has said about the Muslim immigration is damnable for a million different reasons. But this came 24 hours after the President of the United States got on television and said, oh, by the way, I'm going to deny everybody on the no-fly list their due process rights. You know, there were 47,000 people on that list in 2013. You know, studies show that maybe as many as 50% of them may be on that list erroneously, and there has to be an unholy percentage of them are Muslims.
The liberal flip-flop on the due process.
But I still believe. I think this is a stupid issue.
Oh, it is, and it might be pure demagoguery.
We're accepting the fact that we have a list that's bogus, but since when do we have a Republican say, it's good you have a bad list, don't fix it.
Right.
Just keep giving them guns. It's like, fix the damn list.
No, but I mean, on Friday, the New York Times ran an editorial condemning Paul Ryan for standing up for the due process rights of people on the list, which is hilarious because in 2014, the New York Times wrote an editorial condemning the no-fly list as this, you know, erroneous.
We're through the looking glass.
Well, you had them at Paul Ryan.
But your point is essentially that there are bad policies.
There are, and again, it speaks to the media thing. Like, everybody is, you know, dogpiling on Trump again, but nobody's shoving microphones in front of Democrats and saying, hey, do you support denying people due process rights like the president just advocated on national television? I mean, again, you know, I it's an old saw to sit here and complain about liberal media bias, but I mean, this is a classic example.
But
this is
also a much more complicated question. Yeah. That it takes some nuance for people to understand.
It doesn't take that much nuance.
I don't
the Second
think it
Amendment
takes
is a specific
well, maybe the,
enumerated
maybe the
constitutional
press could
right.
digest it for us.
I'm a gin tonic and a half in, and I get it.
It's less nuanced than do you support Donald Trump, who wants to kick people out of the country?
Granted, but it's still. But here's the difference: Donald Trump has never even held elective office. This is the most powerful man in the free world saying this. You'd think that he would be held to a higher standard for rhetoric than Donald Trump, and he's not.
Why don't we switch a little bit? We have a few minutes.
I feel like I need a breather after
Let's just relax, okay, guys? Two basic topics of conversation.
The next drink's on me, Reed.
One is Hillary Clinton, who I think we can all reasonably assume is going to be the Democratic nominee. Who do you think is the best position to take her on if they were to emerge from the Republican primary?
Mm. Impossible question to answer today. Again, for me personally,
are you getting a little bit more scotch, and then you can answer it. Go ahead.
No,
yes, you personally.
I think, look, Chris Christie, if he can break through this Trumpism, which Chris Christie originally owned, this was his persona he created that Trump perfected. Chris Christie is the I will keep you safe candidate. Look, I as a woman, and I've known Hillary Clinton for a long time. I actually like her a lot. I like her as a person. As a woman, yeah, it's pretty cool to see her
exceeding. Mary has just sabotaged her chance of ever running again for Republican office.
No. We got to remember, we serve, we were spouses together, we have a long, you know, whatever. But there's an issue that, as for women, overrides everything, and that is our safety and the safety of our children. Mm-hmm. This issue is critically important right now. There's not a mother who's going taking her kids shopping right now at any mall, Christmas shopping, and it's not thinking for a moment about the safety of their family. Mm-hmm. This is that hand of God thing that came in, and women are saying, I like Hillary, but my kids need to be safe. Who's going to protect me? And this goes back to the Benghazi narrative. Well, it's not going to be that hard, I think, to tie Benghazi into a lack of understanding how dangerous the world is. Mm-hmm. And I think the people will say, look, the people are thinking people in politics will say, you know what, I like her, but I'll give it 4 more years because right now I care about the safety of my family. Mm-hmm. And that is going to be Jeb Bush or Chris Christie or John Kasich or whoever. Well, not I don't want to go that far. It's going to be one of those three people, probably. So the safety thing will win over Hillary.
Do you agree with that?
I don't disagree with what the former congressman just said. Congresswoman, excuse me. If that is the criteria, I mean, Rubio is also incredibly strong.
I'm sorry,
in foreign
Rubio
policy.
Too. Yes,
is also incredibly strong in foreign policy, and poll after poll after polls. And I say this, strictly as an empirical thing. I'm not passing any sort of endorsement.
He served on the Senate Armed Services Committee.
I did not mean to.
I'm just saying that the polls show that, I mean, he's consistently the strongest in head-to-head matches.
If I hadn't been drinking, I would have included Rubio.
you can't really even look at general election polls right now because
garbage.
General election voters have so little awareness of these candidates. But I do think that, and I'm going to take a lot of heat for this, but I do think that if Marco Rubio were our nominee, that the Clinton campaign would be terrified. Mm-hmm. And the reason I think that is because they have basically said that. I mean, this is a guy that would have enormous appeal to Latino voters in a way that no Republican has had ever. He would have enormous appeal to young voters, in contrast with Hillary, who, is this, the age of most millennials' grandmothers. Mm-hmm. He would have enormous appeal to working class voters. He would basically completely eliminate the class warfare argument that the Democrats have counted on. And he would have some appeal to women. Mm-hmm. He's very strong on foreign policy and national security issues. He's very likable. He's like Cory Gardner kind of likable. It's very hard to turn him into the grouchy old rich white guy that they try so hard to turn Republicans into. And he's a good looking guy. Well, I'm not going to suggest that women vote for candidates just because they're good looking. But he would be very formidable for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah,
oh, wow.
I mean,
okay.
I wouldn't go that
drink.
Far.
Drink to that one.
He's a good looking guy.
No.
That's not why I think. I mean, that's obviously an asset in this game. But he cuts into virtually every demographic that the Democrats have to not just win, but have to dominate in.
Right, sure.
And it's very, very challenging. If he's our guy.
I think that's what I've heard, too, from people in and around that Hillary
campaign. No, I think he's the most attractive. I mean, in central casting could easily cast him
and remarkably poised.
Forget all of the all of the abstract, fits this category, whatever, has this appeal. He's just a good candidate. His ability
quick
to speak fluently, quick on his feet, that sort of thing. And Hillary is not a good candidate. I mean, she's really not good. And it's like, I feel like I've been taking crazy pills. People forget, 2008 didn't happen or something, where, this junior senator rode in from nowhere and destroyed her, even though she had all the natural advantages.
Hillary actually is
going back to your point about Jeb and Mitt, I think Hillary actually has more of the weaknesses that Mitt had, meaning that she's somebody that's eminently sort of capable in life, but just has a very difficult time communicating and relating to people, and that was a challenge that Mitt had.
And one of the things that I felt it seemed like whenever you guys put Romney in a situation where he had to speak to like normal people unscripted, where there was always some sort of a danger, like when he was in New Hampshire with the two veterans that turned out to be a gay couple, and he was going on and on about how he was going to ban gay marriage, and one of them said, well, what are you going to say to my husband about that? And Romney just froze. He had no, he was a total deer in headlights. And Hillary, you kind of see that in, she hasn't driven a car in 25 years.
Yeah.
She hasn't, she hasn't had a normal conversation with somebody because she was, whether she was the First Lady of Arkansas or the, in the White House or in the Senate, that she hasn't been a real person in a long time.
And you can't learn normal.
Well, she's a real
you
person.
You either are
she's
normal or you're not. You're
she not, still you is a real person,
but
for the
you
record.
Know, but for, to Katie's
no, but
credit.
She's never been shopping in Harris Teeter. She hasn't been shopping
that we
in
know
Harris
of.
Teeter like our friend Jimmy
like
Gilmore.
Our friend
and,
I will say this.
Wait, I want to go back to
to talk about you. No, look, this is what's scary for us as Republican women, and you've done a lot of work in this area, is we're gonna, we gain inroads, and one somebody in our party comes along and says something so stupid, and they set us back so far. And thank you for
hat
all
tip
of your
Todd
work.
Aiken and Richard Murdoch.
Yes, thank you. So thank you for trying to
those
educate, you know, Neanderthals how to speak the language without having one of those moments. I know you've been working hard and building a career on that. So thank you.
Thank you,
I
thank
know
you for that
hard.
Nod, Mary.
What's
I think I have to toast
what's
you.
What's going on here? Jesus.
Girl power. That's what's going
girl
on.
Girl power.
Teapot. To Teapot. I will say this about Clinton. I think you're absolutely right. Very unskillful campaigner. I think she's, you know, and she hasn't really had those real life experiences. Her only one of her main attributes is that she has this perseverance stuff
right.
to her. So in the 2008 primary, for instance, she only started becoming a good candidate in the eyes of the media when she had lost her lead, when she was at her
which was crying in New Hampshire.
Well, I don't want to dismiss crying. I actually, you know, let's not be too rude about
I'm
it.
I'm pretty
like,
cynical about that moment.
Well, fine, whatever.
It's
the point
it
is,
it doesn't really feel
wait,
real when
it's
Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
I don't think he was condemning crying. I think he was condemning Hillary crying.
I think it seemed fairly calculated.
The point stands, though, which is that she, for some reason, and I think a lot of it's narrative driven, she does her best when she is counted out the most. Now,
right.
Is that when you
actually,
won?
She does her best when she's not a candidate.
That's
and
true.
We have seen
like
her numbers
Secretary
drop
State, yeah.
considerably from the time, yeah. you know, she wasn't a candidate until now.
Yeah.
And unfortunately for her, you know, as Jonah Goldberg has said, you know, political skill is not community property.
Right.
And Bill Clinton has it in spades. Hillary Clinton just doesn't. And if the Republicans do put up a candidate that has sort of a natural ability to connect with people like a Chris Christie, like a Marco Rubio, it's going to spell real trouble for Hillary Clinton.
But who do we
but
think?
What's, and you were talking about the tribal nature of our politics. I mean, what states is Republican nominee X going to win that Mitt Romney didn't win?
Florida with Rubio.
And what else? That's not enough.
Well, it
Nevada?
Depends. Like, for instance,
Mexico?
I think they could win
Colorado?
Any number of these swing states, for instance, with the gun rhetoric, and like they consist on that. They keep going down that drumbeat. I mean, all of a sudden,
I mean, I think,
Colorado,
I think,
New Mexico, and Iowa, all these places are on the table with the guns.
Virginia,
burns,
Florida? You know. I think there's a handful
but that,
of
but
states.
But that's just one example. I mean, I just think that there's a lot for grabs.
It's going to be a close election. Why don't we close on this question, which is my favorite of the bunch. In your estimation to this point, what has been the most eyebrow-raising moment of this Republican primary? It doesn't have to be Trump-related, because I think we're all going to choose
Does anybody
Trump.
Not think it was
I
yesterday?
No, I have
either.
Yeah,
exactly.
Between when we were taping this
one.
And when this goes up, there may be something new.
Sure.
Right.
To this point, to Tuesday, December 8th, what has been... I'll start, because it's not Trump-related. I thought when Ben Carson talked about the pyramids being grain storage... entities? Did I miss this?
That just feels like kicking a puppy.
Oh, come on. That wasn't...
Yeah,
oh, my God. Maybe, I don't know.
Kicking a puppy.
That's not
I'm going to defend Ben Carson
on
this. On
the grain stuff?
I actually am. Which is not to say that I don't think it's true, but that was actually sort of a quasi-common belief in the Middle Ages, that's what they were for, because it matches up with the Bible story. Now, I'm not saying that... Like, I mean, it's subsequently been disproven. Or I should say there isn't any hard evidence for it, but it's not the craziest thing I've ever heard.
I would think he might have stumbled upon that in all of his education.
I love that moment. I love that moment so much.
That is so sweet, though.
All right.
I tried.
Yeah, fair enough.
Me?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Or do I get to play like closer here? It's a Trump moment, but
fair
it's
enough.
Actually, to me, it's a women's moment. And that is how easy it was for Carly to turn that around.
Yeah.
And how everybody ought to take a lesson from that moment. She rocked that moment because, I mean, she tied it into every woman. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a moment more about women than it was about Trump. So eyebrow raising.
Not eyebrow raising,
provided
but inspirational,
you have Botox,
maybe. Yeah.
No Botox.
I have another one that was also a woman moment and was a Trump moment. And I do, for the record, think that he is a major sexist, misogynist pick. So let's just...
What's it you off?
So let's just leave that on the table. But when he mentioned Megyn Kelly,
oh yeah,
and the blood coming out of her eyes or whatever, you know, my natural reaction was to want to get on Twitter and Facebook and defend her. And, you know, I reached out to my friend Dana Perino, who's very close with Megyn, and said, you know, my gut is to want to do this, but I think she probably just wants this to go away. Mm-hmm. Because as a woman, the notion that you could be as accomplished and smart and professional as Megyn Kelly is, and to have your professional career reduced to your menstrual cycle, is so infuriating and offensive to me that I literally see red over it. And the idea that he didn't pay a much bigger price, the idea that Roger Ailes ever allowed him back on Fox Network after being that personally insulting to one of his anchors is as offensive to me as the fact that Trump uttered it. I mean, it is so beyond the pale. We all know exactly what he was talking about. And he's a genius, without a doubt, at saying these things that leave him some wiggle room so that people can question what he actually meant. We all know what he meant. And it was meant to demean and insult her. And it was completely out of line and should be disqualifying for somebody that wants to be the commander-in-chief.
You're here.
And yet.
And yet here we are.
I completely agree, but isn't it kind of a catch-22, which is that if you do deny Trump, you know, access or whatever and make a big deal out of it, you're saying that she, you know, she has to be protected as a woman and she can't take care of herself. Like, I just don't know what you do in that situation. Like, I completely agree.
I think if he had been that personally offensive to any anchor, whether it was male or female, he could have denied access. But, you know, this whole campaign would be going a different way right now if Republican primary voters weren't seeing Donald Trump, and the bulk of them do sit and watch Fox News every night.
Well, I do not disagree with you on that point, for sure.
Eyebrow raising moments.
I mean, I think the, you know, for months back to November and December last year, the sort of elephant in this race was Jeb Bush. You know, certainly at the Wall Street Journal, we pay a lot of attention to Jeb Bush.
Sure.
A lot of his donors are our readers. $12 for 12 weeks. You can sign up.
Fair enough, Reed. You got your plug in, damn it.
The moment when Jeb threw a punch at Rubio in the Colorado debate and just got flattened by Rubio's response.
Yep.
They're like, someone put you up to this when Bush tried to hit Rubio for his attendance record in the Senate. It just felt it felt like Jeb was finished.
Yeah.
Like you thought up to then, you know, he had all this money, no matter how poorly he was doing in the polls, that he was a Bush, he had this network. He was a professional, and then in that moment, it's felt like everything vanished, and he's not
great moment.
He's never hasn't recovered from that since, with the Jeb Can Fix It, with the you know, the various attempts to not necessarily to rebrand but to re-energize the campaign. They've all fallen flat.
Yeah,
his Super PAC ads aren't terribly effective, and
you think that was the moment?
And it seemed like that was the moment where, you know, he had put all of his chips on the table in that spot point and lost everything. And, you know, we haven't seen him recover. And it's hard to envision a scenario where he can.
What were they thinking? I mean, American values, mom, apple pie, and friendship. So right here, we've been friends for years, but I'm going to stab him on the back.
Yeah.
That was just
Well, and especially
horrible.
To telegraph it ahead of time.
Yeah,
I mean, Marco
was
prepared for it, and he was prepared to push back on it in
they
a way
They were literally tweeting
that
about
said,
it all day.
You're better than... I mean, he managed to somehow compliment Jeb in the moment. You know, you're better than this.
Yeah.
And it was pretty brilliant.
All right, you're the last to go. Hold on, before you go, just note, I host the show, I provided you alcohol, Just back me up on the Ben Carson pyramid as the craziest moment.
I
don't let me down.
Let him have his own moment.
Don't let me down.
I would say honestly that the ladies chose the two things.
Oh,
that
you let me
say.
Down. Okay.
Having said that, I probably shouldn't, but why not? I'll just pile onto Trump again. it's sort of in a similar vein in terms of being full metal chauvinist. When Trump signed that lady's boob, and it was kind of amazing.
I had blocked that out, Mark, but thank you for bringing it screaming back to me.
It was the defining moment.
For a second there, I just kind of imagined like what it would be like if Gene Simmons ran for president. And it was kind of funny because if you know anything about Gene Simmons, they basically share the same politics.
Yeah. You thought that would be more respectable?
Yeah. But for a second there, it would have made a little more sense and would have been a little more fun if we had Gene Simmons instead of Trump. But that thought quickly dissipated. And I was left with the fact that modern politics had degenerated to the fact that Donald Trump had signed some lady's boob. And, you know, there we are.
Thank you so much for joining us on Drinking and Talking. It was a great show, wasn't it? A big thanks again to Katie Packard, Mary Bono, Reed Epstein, and Mark Hemingway. And thanks to our fearless editors, Adrian Rosaro, Christine Canetta. You guys, you're the best. I'm your host, Sam Stein, and I encourage you very, very much to subscribe to Drinking and Talking on iTunes, or just check us out at thehuffingtonpost.com. Till then, take care.